nose, the nose, the nose, the nose.
Welcome to the Brothers Zoll podcast, a show 37 years in the making, hosted by David,
John,
and Simeon Zoll. Join us as we recreate some of our favorite dinner table discussions from growing up.
Talking theology, culture, jokes, and everything in between.
Merry Christmas, you two. I am so excited to talk about the subject of Christmas. Now, who knows when people are listening to this, but we are recording it very close to Christmas. And Christmas is such a towering subject and kind of season, and just there's so much related to it. It felt like a no-brainer to do a whole episode on Christmas. But before we jump in, what's going on, you two? Sim, Christmas in Cambridge, I think, is basically the platonic ideal of Christmas, right?
It's pretty great. So it's cold and dark and beautiful Christmas lights on medieval buildings. And it's really, really very wonderful and special. And it also gets dark at 3 p.m. So
that's less special, right? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I don't know what to say except for that. I think every single year I seem to know people who are going to Cambridge for Christmas, because they want to have Christmas at one of the churches. You know, they want to have the famous boys choir.
The King's College Chapel. Yeah.
So, well, John,
have you been to it before, Sim? The actual King's College?
I have never been
service?
To the actual thing. You just have to spend like 12 hours on Christmas Eve doing it, and I just haven't been able to.
Yeah, what's the actual scoop? I'm sure about a million people who we know have fantasized at one point or another about going to that famous service. And like, what is the actual deal with that service?
You go at like 6 a.m. and wait in line all day. And then you go in at 5 o'clock, and they have the most beautiful service with the boys singing and the whole deal. They actually record the one that you hear earlier. And then they do a live one on the day.
Oh, wow.
And then what's the secret hack that you figured out a few years ago?
To go on Christmas Day, when a lot fewer people go, but you still get the boys' choir singing Christmas songs.
You hear that's that, everyone? Brilliant. That's worth the price
that's some
of admission alone.
Really good intel. It's basically a dead show.
No, but you know, English people love their cues, right? And that's a huge cue, basically all day long on Christmas.
Yeah, all day. Yeah.
I wonder how many English people are actually go to that. It must be mostly tourists, I imagine. John.
Yeah. So I love Christmas, and I live in this kind of Christmas wonderland too. I'm just looking out the window at our gorgeous little church, which has a beautiful, huge wreath on the front of it and two Christmas trees on the front steps. And it's just, I live in a kind of Christmas wonderland. Even 100 years ago, everybody literally rode a sleigh to and from church on Christmas Eve here.
I mean, basically, the two of you have the most hateable Christmas settings that I can think of. I mean, John, you have the sort of colonial American New England
stone walls. Who's the guy who paints all those?
Yeah, Thomas Kincaid.
It's Thomas,
Kincaid.
You genuinely have a Thomas Kincaid painting as your Christmas.
Yeah.
And Sim, I've got something even better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Simeon has.
You've got the Gainsborough. For us, we're very excited. We get to host our parents, the Zoll parents, this year, which is kind of a rarity for us. But my three boys are very much in Christmas mode, and we're not. No one is too cool for it. Actually, our oldest is almost too cool for it. But high octane Christmas spirit right now. But I thought I'd set the table here, set the tone by reading that wonderful poem from Madeline L'Engle, entitled First Coming. Maybe you've heard it, but it actually is one of these poems that actually reads quite well. You don't have to look, see it. Here we go. First Coming by Madeline L'Engle. He did not wait till the world was ready, till men and nations were at peace. He came when the heavens were unsteady and prisoners cried out for release. He did not wait for the perfect time. He came when the need was deep and great. He dined with sinners in all their grime, turned water into wine. He did not wait till hearts were pure. In joy he came to a tarnished world of sin and doubt, to a world like ours, of anguished shame he came, and his light would not go out. He came to a world which did not mesh, to heal its tangles, shield its scorn. In the mystery of the Word made flesh, the Maker of the stars was born. We cannot wait till the world is sane to raise our songs with joyful voice. For to share our grief, to touch our pain, he came with love. Rejoice, rejoice.
Wow.
That's great. I've never heard that before.
She could write that that Madeleine L'Engle, that Wrinkle in Time, Episcopalian, I think. John, isn't that right?
Yeah, she was the librarian at St. John the Divine. I attend all of my standing committee meetings in the Madeleine L'Engle Library, where she spent a ton of time. It's
That's
cool.
Amazing. I think I visited Laity Lodge recently, and she spent a lot of time down there in Texas doing a bunch of writing and leading retreats and things. Sort of a towering figure that it probably will have more of a reappraisal, I think, in years to come. She's sort of ripe for it, especially her more religious leanings.
Angels from the realms of glory, stars shone bright above. Royal David's city was bathed in light of love. Ooh. Jesus Christ was born today. Jesus Christ was born.
Guys, let's start. I thought we'd sort of structure this in roughly three parts, sort of begin with the personal, then move to the theological and the cultural. So personal, we celebrated Christmas together, at least for, well, I guess, 18, 19 years, more than that. What are your associations with Christmas growing up? I mean, I will just say for myself, I associate G.I. Joes with Christmas. That's like, for me, I was thinking about it, and we grew up outside in Westchester County, and there was a lot of sledding, a lot of snow, and I just remember a lot of toys. Like, I totally zeroed in on toys. It wasn't until later that even church was a massive part of that day. But I also have very distinct memories of waiting up with John to catch Santa in the act. It was a magical place. We lived in a rectory that was built in stone and had a kind of a Gothic vibe to it. And it felt very Christmassy, you know, especially after mom.
And it was always snowy.
It was always
snowy. And we would go out, you know, and roll giant snowballs. We actually did that, where you take a little snowball and you roll it down a hill and it becomes really, really big.
Yes.
I mean, we sledded.
We had a golf course in our backyard, basically. So there was massive fields and everything, you know, froze, and there was ice skating and stuff like that. So I feel like
I was a baby.
Yeah.
And I was a baby, and I got to read about all that kind of stuff in Calvin and Hobbes later.
I know. Calvin and Hobbes is such a major part of Christmas in the memory.
Christmas was better in the 80s, better in the 1980s.
Tim, what do you remember from Christmases growing up?
Some of my earliest really vivid memories are from that period in New York. Maybe the Christmas when I was 4, when I asked for a Rambo kit and a ninja kit or something.
Oh, yeah, and your kits. I remember that.
Yeah, they got me these and there's like these bricks that I made like a fort with. That was very, very, that was sort of the archetypal Christmas for me. But we had a tree that had, Dad loved colored lights, still loves colored lights. And we had those things that look like, almost like syringes that
yes,
bubble. They're sort
bubbling.
Of like flowery, syringy things that bubble that are, turns out, are super, you know,
flammable.
Cause all kinds of,
right, yeah.
They burn down houses. But they were absolutely magic for me. So looking at the tree and the ornaments is a very, very early memory. So it's not just the toys. Though it's,
you know, I'd forgotten about Lego. Those little like lava lamp syringe things that
have, I've looked for them on the internet.
They're like
times.
A UFO with a syringe coming out filled with red liquid and then bubbles go through it. It's so cool. What about when we moved to Switzerland and got to have live candles on a tree for the first time? That's not very American.
It was pretty special.
It was very special. I mean, you worked forever to have basically 15 minutes of that tree lit completely before it, you know, burnt down the whole house. John, what are your other memories of childhood Christmas?
So, like you said, centering in on toys is a big deal. I probably think about the Christmas where I got all magic tricks. Mm. I was really into magic, and I had a catalog from Tannen's Magic Shop in New York City. And one Christmas, I got a ton. I got a, you know, like a tube that I could put my arm in, and then I would be able to shove a flaming torch through my arm.
I remember that.
A dove pan. I got a necklace where I could cut all the beads off of the thread and put it in my mouth and then re-thread all of the beads and pull it out of my mouth with all the beads back on the thread. You may remember huge coloring books that would change colors depending on how I flipped the pages.
John, yes. I remember the coloring books. Wow.
Yeah. Linking rings, Chinese linking rings. Remember?
So cool.
That was probably one of the all-time great Christmases when I got all the magic tricks.
What's interesting is as I age and especially spend time in like church and Christian circles, you run into people that have ambivalence about Santa Claus. And, you know, I don't remember anything remotely crossing our radar screen like that. In fact, Dad seemed to like, he loves Christmas, and it seemed like he always loved all of it. Like there wasn't a part that he almost didn't privilege any aspect of it. It's just like all of it was fair game. Am I right in remembering it that way?
Yeah, Santa was totally a very happy, fully integrated factor. And the materialism was absolutely fine.
You know what, Pop?
What's that, son?
Christmas just isn't going to be the theme this year.
Well, why is that?
Because Santa's got a brand new bag!
Our Christmas lists, the art of the Christmas list, I started in October every year. Oh, I love to this day making lists of, you know, by hand of things I want.
I remember being in like nativity plays. I was always a star, a shepherd, I think every single time.
It was a big year when I was a wise man. I remember when John was Joseph, that was a sort of a coup. The minister's kid to become Joseph was kind of not done, but I wonder if John, there were some tantrums behind the scenes that kind of engineered that.
I don't know.
That casting. One wonders.
Well, can we talk about the best present that Dad ever got Mom for Christmas?
Yes.
When he gave her an amulet. This is in the height of the 80s, like late 80, maybe 88, 89, 87. But about whatever year the National Geographic issue came out that had the holographic skull on the cover, one of the most memorable issues of National Geographic ever. That's the same year that Dad gave Mom her big present. It came in a black velvet pouch. And when she opened it, she pulled out a gold-rimmed glass amulet. That was a hologram
of an eye.
Of an eye.
That really happened.
And it would open and close depending on which angle you looked at it.
She thought it was, he thought it was like he'd really gotten her a special piece of jewelry, a holographic eye amulet. And that present really.
Like a lead balloon.
Was a flop.
Because she must have thought she was getting a piece of, you know, real jewelry.
Well, he thought it was real jewelry. That's what's so funny.
Well, I guess that was the issue, yes.
But it wasn't. Man, I just remember her disappointment. But also what ultimately became one of the great jokes where for years after we would give it to one another, somebody would get the glass eye amulet as a present every Christmas.
I forgot about that. Christmas time is here So as you've gotten older and had children, how has Christmas changed? Has it changed at all?
Well, I would say there's a distinct other phase of my childhood Christmas, which is when I was a teenager and I'd become a Christian. And I would go to the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham for these glorious Christmas Eve services, especially even when I was in college as well. Mm-hmm. And I discovered the sort of Christmas Eve, you know, midnight mass kind of service. And those were just, to me, those are the greatest church services I've ever been to. I mean, when I think of if I could go back to any church service in the world, I would go back to circa, 1999 to the Advent 8 o'clock or 11, whatever it was, evening service there. It was packed. It was beautiful. They had brought in all these musicians. You would go up for communion between the choir, would sing on either side of you. I remember them singing, What Child Is This? Green Sleeves, as I was going up just in the with candles everywhere, and it just captured the mystery, the majesty, the glory, and the depth of Christmas in a way that was new. I mean, the childhood stuff, it was very special and magical, but then when it had this deeper religious dimension for me later, it became my favorite service of the year.
It's true, Sam. When I think about the sacred element of Christmas, I have some recollection of Germany and candles in St. Mary's Scarborough, maybe singing Silent Night. But what I really remember are O Come All Ye Faithful late in the evening, sort of the nighttime service in Birmingham, feeling that now that we would just talk about it as being transcendent and like the truly
sublime
church experience that kind of stays with you your whole life. John, what would you say? When was the deepening of this kind of sacred element of Christmas?
Well, those services that you're referring to definitely made an impression on me too. I could sort of picture it. Mm-hmm. It just felt magical. But I mean, I don't know. I kind of always loved Christmas, but I always felt a little like it was hard to place within the larger kind of setting of faith a little bit, maybe.
What do you mean by that?
It just feels to me a little bit like an outlier in terms of being at night. You know, it's so weird that it's a holiday that's mainly celebrated at night in church. Mm-hmm. But basically, yeah, I remember sublime Christmas Eve services. And I also remember Dad coming home on Christmas morning because, you know, I still, as Dad did, I have to do a Christmas morning service.
Yeah.
The one that always only five people come to. And I remember doing that. Dad would come home from that service and we would open all of our presents. And then he would go off into his office as we would play with our presents. And he would write thank you notes for every single present that he got from a parishioner. And then when he was finished writing 50 thank you notes or 100 thank you notes, he would come out of his office and we would have our Christmas supper.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that was happening.
I also remember he was so frantic about throwing things away, wrapping paper, you know, as often.
Yeah, he's really chilled out on that with age. He's really, Dave, you'll see this Christmas.
I think every year he throws out some very important present. That's kind of become something he's known for doing.
He does sometimes almost light the living room on fire by burning stuff.
Well, thank you everyone for indulging us as we kind of go down that memory lane. But it's
basically we had great Christmases.
We had great Christmases. And I don't remember now being on the upper end of it. It's a very demanding and stressful time for clergy. And I don't remember Dad actually being that stressed out during that time. I think I know it's a huge production that you're putting on, sometimes four times in a day. And I remember him being tired, but he loved Christmas so much that it was always a joyful thing. It wasn't like be quiet, your father needs to work on a sermon or something like that. That never had that sense.
No.
He found it easy to preach also. He loved preaching on Christmas. That was, he just always, some of his best sermons were
Christmas
inevitably,
and Good Friday.
Christmas and Good Friday. That'll do.
That'll do.
I remember Dad telling me, you know, Martin Luther's favorite was Christmas, not Easter. You know, and sort of like without Christmas, you don't get any of the others. You know, it sort of ushers in all of the other things we love about the faith.
Do you remember there was a year where he, as we were young adults, he gave each of us a volume of Martin Luther's Christmas sermons. And I remember reading that very early on when I was sort of taking my faith seriously again. And those are wonderful sermons. I still go back to them. And I was looking on the early days of Mockingbird. Every Christmas, we'd post lengthy things from Luther's Christmas sermons. That would probably be a recommendation at the end.
Christmas time.
Let's do it. Let's dive into the theology here of Christmas. The big word that I want to start with is incarnation. Now, it's a beautiful word. It's perhaps, you know, in a current context, maybe a little overdone. But how do you understand the incarnation, its importance? Sim, I want to hear from you first and lay the groundwork for the incarnation with a capital I.
When I lecture about the incarnation, one thing that I do is I use Christmas carols, because a lot of the technical stuff around the doctrine about Christ's divine nature and human nature and stuff sounds extremely abstract and heady, and why would anyone care about this? And you're always trying to help 18, 19-year-olds understand why someone would care about this, even if they don't. But, and then Christmas carols, you say they're just about these ideas about God becoming human. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, John 1:14. That's the ground zero verse. That is the Christmas verse. Mm. And the light shone in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Those two things, between those, and then you overlay the story, especially from Luke, and you have Christmas. So the incarnation is God becoming human. And that's an idea that you can think about your whole life. I mean, how drastic a problem there needed to be for the God who created all things, who invented time, to come and take on human flesh. There's an intimacy that is basic to Christianity about the relationship between Christians and their God that is so completely grounded. It's even Jesus being a person who talks and who you can relate to, all that depends on his becoming human. And then the actual story of his becoming human, the story of the incarnation, it just means the enfleshment, basically, the taking on of flesh, the John 1:14 thing, is this incredibly beautiful, slightly weird, utterly iconic, and very simple image of this baby being born at night, laid in a manger, and then angels—
In great humility.
In great humility. And angels, I mean, the very idea of God being a baby, and then angels announcing that this is the greatest news that could possibly be. So you have this very specific imaginative world that you're drawn into to put clothing on what kind of philosophically, theologically is a huge deal for God to become human, is a very strange and very beautiful thing.
You know, my friend said it kind of the incarnation can almost be translated as you are not the solution to your problems. Like it's
an intervention into a world of dark.
And coming down, Mary Carr has a wonderful series of poems called Descending Theology. And it's really all about Christmas and the descent, God coming down. That's the movement. That's the direction, I think, of the gospel. And it's made so clear on Christmas. I think, what does Buechner say? It's like the God of the universe with a skull you could crush one-handed. something like
Goodness
that.
Goodness me.
You know, you just read that Madeleine L'Engle poem, and it does such a good job of capturing the comfort is this idea of God coming to us. You know, and so much of the sort of Advent buildup and time of year leading up to Christmas feels all about, in the church especially, it's this sort of preparation that we do, and obviously our lives in getting ready for Christmas with buying presents for people and wrapping them and anticipating all the like family dynamics and the meals and all of that stuff. It feels so much like it's up to us to get ready for Christmas. And the great news here too is this idea of God coming to us, regardless of whether you're ready or not, you know, he is coming to town. I love that. It always feels like it's about us getting ready when in truth, regardless of whether we're ready or not,
he's coming.
He's coming.
Isn't that beautiful?
And that's good news.
Yeah, I mean, Sim, I've heard people riff on the incarnation as being like a God blessing, you know, material like bodies and creation. And I know that's there's an element to that. But I would just say pastorally, what I find so moving about it is the kind of God not only coming to us, but also coming to us in such an unexpected way. He does not come, you know, with a sword and, you know, as a conquering golden Alexander the Great, but as a baby. And what is a baby is except for something you can't, you know, the pure weakness.
Part of the magic, the enchantment of Christmas. If ever there's, if there's anything in the world that you can use the word enchantment correctly about, it's Christmas. It casts a spell. It's this time of sort of enchantment. And I think that is connected to the idea of God being, when God enters the whole world becomes special. The whole world becomes filled with meaning and possibility in a different kind of way. There is something, and you realize what the significance of the whole world was at the whole time, which was God, and a God who is loving and humble. So I'm perfectly here for the sense that it's an affirmation or of all that's good here in a way that allows us to see it again, even though there's so many reasons to not see it. So I'm okay with that. That's why it's so magical. That God is here. He's not out there. He's not an idea. Mm-hmm. He's actually here with us, right in the thick of it.
And he's also in the rejected. Like, I mean, isn't that the no room at the inn? We're born in a stable. The shepherds were grimy. As much as we've beautified Christmas, and in a Thomas Kincaid, almost like Bedford, New York, kind of Cambridge, UK kind of way, the reality of the first Christmas was likely light years away from that. And it was just a garage, essentially, with some very strange characters, as not to mention animals. But John, talk to us more about, like, you've preached these Christmas sermons all of, like, I've never actually gotten to preach on Christmas Eve because I'm never there.
Right.
What do you say, and what has been most impactful, or what do you, how would you sum up, like, kind of the best Christmas sermon you've ever given?
One of my favorites, I've had to preach it, you know, every year, and I get very nervous about it because I want it to always do justice. And people always say, well, just retell the story. It's so magical in and of itself. And there's some truth to that. You want to just sort of revisit the elements of the story. But I'm always looking for some fresh foothold annually. And it varies. My favorite that I've ever preached is, I think I've talked about how years ago I worked at this, I took a communion service weekly to a retirement home. And there was a woman who would receive the sacrament every week when I came, named Nancy. And Nancy had severe Alzheimer's. Her husband would bring her to the service. And she usually would sit on the far end of the table. But one year at Christmas time, I brought my little baby daughter, Daphne, to the retirement home. And the moment that this old woman, who was not fully able to be herself because of her sort of dementia, the moment that she saw my daughter, she got up from the far end of the table and just walked around so that she could just hold my little daughter's hand or foot. And I had to eventually say, okay, Nancy, it's time to start the service. Go back to your seat with Milton, you know. And she could not stay in her seat. She had to keep getting up and coming over because she had no filters. And so when she was sort of reduced to pure response to sensory phenomena,
yeah,
her default when she was confronted with an infant was to get out of her chair and go over to the baby and to be in its presence. And I really feel that I learned something there, which is that God, in revealing himself in the form of an infant, was appealing to something that is so deeply primal within human nature that we really have to almost have a screw loose in order to not respond in a kind of involuntary way to this image of an infant. I think about how if somebody suddenly placed an infant on your lap, what would it do to your mindset? Would you not immediately pick up the child and cradle the child? How would you feel about all of the concerns that were filling your mind on the front end? And so I love the image of the infant. I think that is about as insightful and inspired a poetic draw for the human being as ever has been conceived of. And if you just sort of think God knew what he was doing, like you contrasted that with, say, like a Roman centurion arriving in a golden chariot, you know, with a thunderbolt. The contrast between infant and, you know, Greek God with a thunderbolt is so pronounced and so inspired, and it just completely undoes. So I'm always drawn to the child piece. I usually want to highlight how also if God first appears on the scene in the form of an infant, it's a message of tenderness, and it's the antithesis of judgment. And so if this is sort of, you only get one chance to make a first impression, we tend to think, you know, what do you make of God if this is the lead in? What does it tell us about the heart of God toward us? And it comes both as a great relief and something we almost can't help but respond to.
I love all of that. The thing that has really captured my kind of Christmas theological imagination for a very long time, and I've been thinking about it even more lately, is, you know, the carols and the stories. I mean, so the fact that it takes place at night. Christmas draws very, very powerfully on imagery of darkness into which light comes. We were saying earlier that it's a little weird that it's, you know, religious holiday celebrated entirely or primarily at night. And the main image is at night because the shepherds are watching their flocks by night. And the biblical texts are drawing on a tradition, especially in Isaiah, of God's good news coming as a light or as a new dawn into a world of darkness. The classic text is the people who walked in darkness who have seen a great light upon those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death. On them light has shined, Isaiah 9:2, and it's quoted in Matthew, and it's implied in John 1. And that image, so you have this baby. I mean, because why is it that the Christmas story, you know, people might think it's sentimental, but it's actually not. It doesn't come across as sentimental. Part of its universal appeal is that it's more, you know, it could be sentimental if it's centered on a baby. But I think the reason it isn't is because of the implicit horizon of the night, of the dark, of the people walking in darkness, that it is into that world that a light has shined. I mean, so, you know, the first line of O Holy Night, long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared and the soul felt its worth, a thrill of hope. The weary world rejoices for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. That's a poetic image that has an incredibly deep resonance existentially, biblically. And then just down to, that's why we have candles, why we have Christmas trees. They are light in the dark. You know, Christmas trees only, they don't look good when all the lights are on, you know, in the room. You turn off the lights for the Christmas tree to shine. And that is this the most simple thing in the world. And yet, who doesn't feel that the world is dark and that they are walking in darkness and they are never far from the shadow of death? Who does not want light to shine on their darkness and so on? So, and I think a lot of the great carols, maybe I'll talk about that later, are playing very directly on that. There's a seriousness about the human condition that is actually, that is really genuinely there in the fact that this is happening in the dark. The light is coming in the dark. Silent night is you're gazing on this baby, but the whole image is of light coming from the baby's radiant beams, you know, with the dawn of redeeming grace. It's this imagery of light coming in the night.
That's, I mean, there's just so much to this.
What about you, Dave? What's another sort of theme that stands out to you?
Well,
or if you were going to preach on Christmas Eve, where do you think you might be drawn?
Well, I sometimes would say there are a couple different things. I think people are very, very lonely, and Christmas time can be a time, just like Thanksgiving, when you're extremely aware of who's not there. And if you've just lost a loved one, you're alone. Or if the worst loneliness is the loneliness you feel in a crowd of people. Maybe it's your family or your whatever it may be. And so there is an element of the Christian message, or the Christmas message, is that God is with you, that you're not alone. And the way I often understand the revelation of God is that, you know, Christmas tells us that God is with us, and Easter and Good Friday tell us that God is for us. And I want to have them both. Like, I don't just want one or the other. But Christmas is sort of the time to emphasize the with part. But I would also go, if I were to preach about it, I would emphasize that. And then talk about, but this is not just a God who's sort of ambivalent or comes with judgment. And in a way, you know, the Santa myth is so, it's such an instinctual myth that we would create of deserving, of naughty nice lists, of a kind of a gift-giving deity who you deserve what you get, and lumps of coal and all that. And I happen to have a lot of time for Santa Claus. I love Santa Claus. I don't actually view Santa Claus as some judgmental jerk, and yet I would say that the myth and a lot of the songs around Santa Claus are, they resonate so deeply with a kind of a law-based understanding of the world.
Like naughty and nice.
Naughty and nice.
He's making a list, yeah, checking it twice.
All that stuff. And that's just a brilliant foil for talking about what Christmas is about. And it's not God coming to the deserving, but to the shepherds and to, you know, the unmarried mother. I know that for a lot of women, especially, like, thinking about Mary and being pregnant and being alone, and that it can be a very profound time, because of all the uncertainty that you have with having a baby and the discomfort, and there's that. So there's so, I mean, like, Christmas, I think, is like, you know, it's a diamond. You just, you can turn it, yes, all sorts of ways and see so much stuff to it.
With a thankful heart, with an endless joy, with a growing family, every girl and boy will be nephew and niece to me.
Nephew and niece to me.
Will bring love, hope, and peace to me.
Love, hope, and peace to me.
Yes, and every night will end, and every day will start, with a grateful prayer and a thankful heart. With an open smile and with open doors, I will bid you welcome. What is mine is yours. With a glass raised to toast your health.
With a glass raised to toast your health.
And a promise to share the wealth.
Promise to share the wealth.
I will sail a friendly course, file a friendly chart, on a sea of love and a thankful heart.
I would lean personally on a lot of the cultural allusions, because there's just so many great Christmas movies, Christmas carols, Christmas stories that are drawn to the profundity of the message, even if they're drawn, even if they're dressed up in Santa Claus stuff. I mean, the elf on the shelf thing that America has kind of, that has really bought into. I mean, that's almost like the most extreme version of Santa as being this sort of surveillant god who is basically a behavior, is primarily interested in enforcing good behavior. Now, I know that most of the people that I know who do the elf on the shelf, it's almost all just playfulness and sort of pranking each other. And that's really, so in practice, it's a different thing.
But it's fun to highlight the difference between Santa and Jesus.
Yes,
because
hugely.
The themes are so divergent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yes. And yet I think part of why Santa works within Christmas is that that's actually not how he's experienced generally. He's basically a guy who comes and brings you presents for no particular reason down a chimney. And he's, you know, that he's jolly, you know, he's, I think we there's also a graceful Santa.
Well, let's just talk about there was a real Santa, right? St. Nicholas is a real person, a bishop in the church, you know? And so when people always say, well, how do you feel about Santa? I say, oh, St. Nick? Yeah, real guy. Of course I believe in St. Nick. Mm. Don't you know about, you know, his famous ministry and, you know, punching Arius or whatever? And I mean, like, I just quickly want to act as though that's not some sort of fictitious additional component, but
the Victorians made Christian. It somewhat different, but I get what you're
sure. The art, you know, it's become something, but I just want to sort of double down and say, of course I believe in St. Nick. like, haven't you studied your church history?
What's wrong?
I believe in Napoleon.
Exactly. That's what it's like.
But there's a school out there that says, oh, with all the Santa stuff, you're lying to your children and you're setting up a kind of a dangerous precedent. And someone who values playfulness and the word you said, enchantment. I think any opportunity we have for enchantment, at least hinting at the true enchantment of the world that I, you know, cannot get away from as a Christian. Like, I feel Santa is this great invitation to that. And
absolutely.
Right? I mean,
You don't judge the dreaming based on the quality of the dream. You know, if you kill the dream, you kill the dreaming, right? And I just love to sort of foster I don't think that there's this disappointment that ultimately eats away at one's capacity to have faith when one, you know, sort of has the kind of Santa myth exploded, that it says, oh, well, then everything I've been told is a lie. And you know what I mean?
I can't trust anyone.
I know.
Yeah.
It's more like, oh, I experienced what it was like to have wonder and awe and hopes and, you know, to sort of pin.
Yeah, you wonder if any child really grows up, he's like, you know, I really resent my parents for this, for pretending about Santa Claus. Like, that's the source of my gripe with them. Because it taught me not to trust them. It's like,
I can't trust my parents. They told me about Santa, and look.
It's much more about the parents feeling like weird about kind of deception or something like that. But
they got to get in touch with their playfulness. Like you said, that's,
I know.
That's so key.
I served, the second parish I served in Charleston called Grace Church Cathedral. They had this tradition that built on that question of loneliness at Christmas time, David, that you highlighted. There's a service that's, I thought was maybe a little hokey or maybe even sort of somber, that they do in a lot of Episcopal churches now, called a Blue Christmas service, which is a service designed to commemorate and take into account the fact that many people at Christmas are feeling especially lonely and or are mourning and grieving the loss of loved ones. Mm. And so I would go into this service. I had to preach it a few times, and then it would be mostly widows, a few widowers, and then a few other people. And we had these incredible choirs at the cathedral there. It's this amazing music program. And what the dean always did at Blue Christmas when we were acknowledging the loneliness and the sadness and the grief and the loss that surfaces every year at this time, mostly for the elderly who maybe get five presents. Imagine as you get older, you'll get less and less presents. Imagine, you know, how when you get to a point where you'll only get two Christmas cards in the mail, or maybe you'll get two presents, you know, and it'll be sort of an afterthought when you're the aunt or the uncle. You know, that'll happen to all of us. And a service that takes into account how Christmas has sort of bled out is actually very moving and appropriate. Mm. But what we would do in place of a homily or a sermon at that service is we would have the children's choir come in and sing. And it was the voices of children that so touched and spoke to the longing and lonely human heart in a way that God speaks at Christmas in his infant child. It was deeply powerful. And Christmas, any bridge we have to our hearts through the childlike piece is, I think, really powerful. But I always remember there was nothing we could say that would be half as healing or moving or appropriate on the build-up to Christmas for our elderly parishioners than to just have a bunch of little five-year-olds come in and sing a song about Jesus, we greet thee, you know.
Wow.
I loved that.
That's beautiful. Well, another element that I would sometimes preach on, at least in the leading up to it, is Mary and Joseph. I think that the faith that you see on display there is, it, you know, we usually tend to think of the birth, the virgin birth, as the great miracle of Christmas or simply the incarnation. But, you know, I would often stress the faith that you see that Joseph has and especially that Mary has. You can understand why these figures would be venerated, because who has faith like that? I mean, I don't. Joseph sticks with this woman, and, you know, wouldn't that be very difficult as a, speaking as a man, that would be difficult to stick with a woman who's gotten pregnant. It wasn't from you, no matter where it's coming from. So that kind of, I sort of emphasize the double miracle of the faith. And then you see Mary sort of, let it be unto me as it, you know, as you say, there's that acquiescence, the passivity there, the receptivity. We have another huge strain, I think, of Christmas thought to me has to do with gift. And, you know, Jesus as the great gift of God, or the grace and gift are also often synonyms. And, you know, this idea that it's more blessed to give than to receive. I mean, although I know that that's like in the Bible as something I think Paul says, but we really get to the point of it's more blessed to receive than to give. And Christmas is actually about receptivity. And that can be a deep affront to our pride and our feeling like, well, we have something to give the world, not vice versa. I don't want to accept your charity. But gift giving is another, like, just, it's just another avenue of talking about this. Like, am I giving to get something in return? Am I giving to garner a certain response? Am I giving only because I'm going to get gratitude in, you know, back?
Or to avoid my kid being annoyed.
To avoid my kid being, or my, you know, the gift of God on Christmas, the reason we give these gifts is sort of in tribute and mimicry of that. And to me, the giftedness, the gifting is something that you can't really, anyone who's ever gotten a major present in their life that they didn't expect at the right time knows that that is a feeling akin to grace. That's, it's a life-changing experience, right?
Absolutely.
Another theme that the God with us, right? Emmanuel, God is with us, you know, that you highlighted around loneliness. But to me, it's also like God becoming enfleshed, God entering into the human plight that Simeon sort of highlighted. That is another theme that's really profound. If you have a problem and the person helping you enters into the problem with you, it's a very different feeling than the one of the person advising from above. Hmm. And so I often talk about in sermons on Christmas about how Christmas reveals the sort of the empathetic heart of God, that he did not wait for us to ascend or to enter into his territory, but rather descended and entered into the midst of all that is broken, and a kind of solidarity that conveys a deep compassion
to those who are mourning in lonely exile, right? Isn't that the...
Yeah, one of my favorite Christmas illustrations I've ever preached is the one about this soldier back from Iraq and Afghanistan, I think where he served, was dealing with major PTSD. And a friend of mine was a therapist at the VA. Her name's Martina. And she told me this story about one of her patients that she was working with, how it would start. They would come in and first meeting would be over the phone. The second meeting, the big breakthrough would be when the person would actually come to their office. Just leaving the apartment was a big deal. And then they would go together in a car to a Walmart, you know, and be surrounded by strangers. And slowly there was this sort of exposure process that one would go through in order to sort of reinculturate. And the final step for this individual in his therapy was going to be, he decided he wanted to attend a baseball game. And there's a team in Charleston, AAA team, the Charleston River Dogs. And so this guy said, okay, here goes, I'm going to do it. And he went up to the ticket counter and he bought his ticket and he walked in and he sat down in the bleachers surrounded by people and everything was going great. And then the heavens opened up and it just started to a torrential downpour, southern afternoon downpour. And everybody got up from the bleachers and ran up to the top of this sort of tiny metal outstretched awning at the top of the bleachers. And they were all sort of crammed together like sardines in this space, the only dry space there. And he looked up and he saw everybody cramming together and he just couldn't do it. And so instead he sat there alone in the middle of the bleachers, getting soaked. And that's when he felt a tap on his shoulder and he looked over and it was, I kid you not, the owner, co-owner of the Charleston River Dogs, Bill Murray, the famous actor and comedian. And Bill Murray sat down next to this guy in the middle of the rainstorm and said, how's it going? And what's going on? And the guy bore his soul. I can't believe you're here, PTSD, Afghanistan, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, all this stuff. And Bill Murray said, I tell you what, I'll see to it that you've got season tickets. And why don't you come back next week for the next game and we'll redo this whole thing. And basically, he was befriended by none other than Bill Murray in the rain, in his frailty, when he couldn't take another step. And to me, that is the dear Christ enters in. You know, that's the message of the incarnation and the empathy of God that is writ large at Christmas.
That's so beautiful.
Thanks for letting me.
No, and it's also, you know,
true story.
I love that when the angel says that for he will save people from their sins, like that's the salvation aspect is right there. You know, it's not invented or foisted upon this beautiful incarnational moment.
Oh, check the hall with
we should be taping this.
Now, how did that happen? That happened because it's Christmas Eve, I'm telling you.
I'm not crazy. It's Christmas Eve. It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer. We smile a little easier. We share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be. It's a miracle. It's really a sort of a miracle because it happens every Christmas Eve. And if you waste that miracle, you're going to burn for it. I know what I'm talking about. You have to do something. You have to take a chance. You do have to get involved. There are people that are having trouble making their miracle happen. There are people that don't have enough to eat. There are people that are cold. You can go out and say hello to these people. You can take an old blanket out of the closet and say, here. You can make them a sandwich and say, oh, by the way, here. I get it now. And if you give, then it can happen. Then the miracle can happen to you. It's not just the poor and the hungry. It's everybody who's got to have this miracle. And it can happen tonight for all of you. If you believe in this spirit thing, the miracle will happen, and then you'll want it to happen again tomorrow. You won't be one of these bastards who says Christmas is once a year and it's a fraud. It's not. It can happen every day. You just gotta want that feeling. And if you like it and you want it, you'll get greedy for it. You'll want it every day of your life, and it can happen to you. I believe in it now. I believe it's gonna happen to me now. I'm ready for it. And it's great. It's a good feeling. It's really better than I felt in a long time. I'm ready. Have a Merry Christmas, everybody.
But Sim, let's hear from you a little bit. I know that you've been banding around the term the metaphysics of Christmas as relates to Christmas carols. You've already mentioned that a little bit, but I'd love for you to give us a little preview or explanation of what you mean when you talk about these things.
So my interest in thinking about this, the metaphysics of Christmas, a couple of years ago, we went to with my kids here we went to a big band show, like a sort of jazzy big band show for Christmas, and we were all excited to go, sort of hear a Christmas concert. And so we go, and it's a very high quality band in this sort of venue, and they start playing these songs, and they play, Walking in a Winter Wonderland, and they play Baby It's Cold Outside, and they play, one after another of these kind of Christmas adjacent sort of winter songs, basically. And there's a ton of them. All I Want for Christmas Is You, it just on and on and on. At first it was like, okay, that's fine. I like, who doesn't like, Walking in a Winter Wonderland and being cozy with hot chocolate and stuff like that. But by the time you've heard the 11th one, and it's clear that they're not going to go there with anything religious at all, I was just left with the sense of, this is so, so thin. This sense of sort of winter festivities, why is this? I find this, it's like if someone, you go to a 5-course meal and they gave you M&Ms for the first course, and then they gave you M&Ms again for the second course, and then for the third course, and maybe some hot chocolate, by the end, you're like, this is terrible. So I found it extremely uncomfortable. And not because I was annoyed, but just because it was grating on me, these songs. Why do we care so much about these songs? And I realized what was missing is any kind of what I would say metaphysical depth. There was no statement about the nature of the human condition or the nature of reality, or you can't be ministered to basically by those songs. And I was going, I realized I'd gone because I wanted help in my life in some way by contact with Christmas, and I didn't get it. And so I was then contrasting that with the Christmas carols, all the sort of classic, A Little Town of Bethlehem and Hark the Herald Angels Sing and Joy to the World and Oh Come All You Faithful. And just what is really going on that these are such endlessly attractive songs. And then around the same time, I had this experience of going to a college. So here in Oxford and in Cambridge, you have these college, they celebrate Christmas at the end of the fall term, which is actually in early December. It's like a thing. I went to this college chapel service that I was asked to read at, this Christmas carol service. And I had been to chapel services before. There'd been maybe 15, 20 people there, the choir, these beautiful spaces with candles and beautiful liturgy and so on, but no one there, really. There were very few people there except with a few exceptions. And I get there 5 minutes early and I can't get in the door, because the entire student body of the college is sort of vying to get in and having their tickets checked and stuff. Because, and it turns out, these services are incredibly popular every single year at Oxford and Cambridge colleges. I just went to one a few weeks ago in my college just across the courtyard, and I had to get tickets 3 weeks in advance. And so, but there we were singing these Christmas carols that are these traditional Christmas carols that have so much depth. And I was trying to think about what the nature of the depth is, and it's a little bit like what I was talking about before, but so on the one hand, the Christmas carols, actually the traditional ones, have actually a pretty dark view of what's happening in the world.
In Bethlehem in Israel, this blessed babe was born, and laid within a manger upon this blessed morn, the which his mother Mary did nothing take in scorn. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy.
They are assuming that the world is, we're mourning and lonely exile here, this the weary plain as far as the curse is found, you know, that line in, is it Joy to the World, implying the whole world is under a curse. You know, God rest you, merry gentlemen, says tidings of comfort and joy. We hear that all the time. But what the actual context is that he freed us all from Satan's power when we had gone astray. I mean, there's this very clear sense of a world gone wrong, human beings gone wrong, of oppression and suffering and the dark. People who walk in darkness is us. So that is the context in which this good news of Christmas is coming, and the baby and the light and the angel's proclamation of the good news. And so there are a few things sort of like, so on the one hand, there's this view of the world that's actually quite serious, quite sober, quite a view that you can actually bring your genuine real pain to. It's not sentimental.
Taxes.
Yeah, that's
taxes, right? Yes. It's like the whole context is taxes, right?
Taxes and moving. I mean, the two worst parts of life.
So it's not this saccharine sweet thing. Once you sort of start looking at what we're really saying in these carols, for example, and what the stories are, the texts are really saying. But the reason why this is good news in this dark world has everything to do with the identity of the child. You know, what child is this who laid to rest on Mary's lap is sleeping? It is the, who is this child? And this is not just a symbol of hope. This is the actual God of the universe who has come to intervene in this world of need, as world of desperation, and in this very meek and beautiful and peaceful and form in all the ways we've talked about. So it's, you're being brought in with these carols into a world that is really genuinely serious and difficult, but also then a world in which there is a God who not only can but is actually intervening to make a difference. There's a light shining in the darkness. So those are the kinds of things. So there's a vision of reality that lies behind these carols that I think helps, is part of what makes them so profound, and why they are so enduringly compelling, even if the person doesn't actually explicitly have any kind of Christian faith. And I mean, the last thing I'll say, my favorite of all Christmas carol lyrics is from the first verse of A Little Town of Bethlehem, because it captures all of this as simply as it possibly could. A little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie above thy dark and dreamless sleep. The silent stars go by, yet in thy dark streets shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. So you have this darkness, the dark streets into which the everlasting light has come. So what I was talking about earlier. And also this line, the hopes and fears of all the years, that is a theologically rich statement. That is the incarnation. That is all of our hopes of any possible better future in light of whatever we're suffering from or with, or whatever's wrong with the world, our hopes, but also our fears, all human fears and concerns and sense that maybe the darkness is all there is. All those things are being met in the fact that this person represents the hopes, shows understanding of the fears by taking on human flesh. And it's just the most lovely thing that could possibly be said. So contrast that with walking in a winter wonderland and drinking hot chocolate, and you know, it's pretty clear where I'm going to put my vote.
Yeah,
I preached on that last Sunday, Simeon. I have when I moved into St. Matthew's Rectory, I found in the attic a photograph and a framed letter written by Phillips Brooks.
Oh wow! Who's the author of A Little Town of Bethlehem?
Exactly. So I sort of joke it's like finding a, you know, an autographed Mickey Mantle rookie card, the Anglican equivalent. And I found that, and I have it hanging in my office normally, but I actually broke it out and showed it from the pulpit, like an object lesson, and talked about hopes and fears are met in thee. And I sort of encouraged the congregation, do you have any hopes this year? Do you have any fears this year? Give them to God as your Christmas gift. You know, that was sort of the image.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie above thou deep and dreamless sleep. The silent stars go by, yet in thy darkest shining street the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight.
I think sometimes something what you're saying, Sim, to me jives with another subject that we're tackling this season about free will, but people are drawn, John, they're drawn to the baby. They're drawn to the Christmas carols out of their heart, you know, and not out of their mind necessarily. And there's a, like a, there's a pull that is overwhelming. And yes, it can be sentimentalized, but there's also just simply something deeply ingrained that the human spirit responds to that I think is, it doesn't even know why it's responding sometimes, right? And yeah. And
absolutely.
And I love that aspect. Like people will flock to these carols because, or into lessons and carol services for long after they've emptied the churches, because there's something there. I remember Marilyn Robinson once said, the reason people come to church on Christmas and Easter is not just because that's when they feel they should come. It's the times when they're assured that they're going to hear good news. You know, unless you really have lost the plot and your Christmas sermon becomes about how people aren't doing enough or in some way, or, you know, be more like the shepherds, or I don't know how people would do that. But generally speaking, Christmas and Easter in the hot far right and the far left, they're reserved for like actual hope. Right. And that accounts for, I think, their appeal in a lot of ways, but it's also a heart appeal. It's an affective thing that you.
Absolutely. And that's why Christmas is so great for that reason. I mean, it's not really about the propositional stuff. Like what are we, you know, technically, you know, what is happening? We could talk all day about those details, but you don't do that on Christmas. You sing the songs, you light the tree, you hold a candle and sing Silent Night.
I buried this guy a few years ago named Bart, and his wife, when they first introduced themselves to me, she said, he'll tell you he doesn't believe any of this stuff, but the moment we start singing a Christmas carol, he'll be the one with tears streaming down his face.
That's it.
You know, and, that's
it.
And
I think my favorite is It Came Upon a Midnight Clear. Little Town of Bethlehem, I found a version of it this year by Sister Rosetta Tharpe, which we'll probably put inserted in. It's just so beautiful.
2,000 years of wrong.
Yes.
This world has suffered long.
Can I just highlight one final theme here that you've sort of all touched on, which is that, and I think we've all covered it, there's both the sort of fixed elements of the story, and then there are the undulations of our life, and the way that this story always seems to speak to something that's both sort of maybe primal or childlike or heart led that we all have with us at all times and are only able to access sort of in this time of year accesses like a skeleton key, that part of our lives, which we all sort of crave. But I also think of it as being a bit of a kind of Rorschach where it highlights elements of our life. Every year, I'm always curious to see which part of the story is speaking to me. David, you talked about Joseph and Mary, you know, or I talked about the baby. Or it could be the no room at the inn. You know, I've had parishioners who are in the middle of moving. One year I had to preach Christmas right after I'd made a move of, you know, 2,000 miles to a new place. And I remember so identifying with the kind of on the move element of the story, how they're not able to be in their home when everything sort of breaks loose. And then I had parishioners. I remember last year a parishioner came and she was hugely pregnant. You know, and I just thought, I wonder what Christmas is like if you're hugely pregnant and expecting a baby any day now, how fertile this story can be. And there's always something. It could be the straw in the manger. You know, it could be taxes. You know, I mean, it could be any element, but I love, it could be the shepherds, you know, sort of, wow, these folks who were never included in anything are suddenly the main message bearers and the first ones who get to know. It's sort of so strange that they're really the ones on the inside for a change. There's so many, the night versus the day, you know, there are endless elements that we can connect with as we play our lives up against the backdrop of this fixed storyline every year. Yeah. And I just love the way we can always kind of find that it has a kind of, archaeological effect on bringing to the surface whatever's really going on with us.
I do. I think that's 100% true. There's just, again, the Christmas story, the Christmas accounts, there's a reason why, you know, Charlie Brown's Christmas special continues to resonate, why Christmas Carol continues to get remade. It's touching. It's so multidimensional, multifaceted. And I just Anyway, I'm grateful for the chance to talk about it with the two of you guys. Touched on Advent, we haven't touched on, you know, heavenly hosts. Really, there's the angel Gabriel. There's so much more to it. But I think what I would like to hear from you guys is some sort of recommendations, or like when you want to bask in Christmas or Christmas in July. Maybe someone's listening to this, and you know, in the middle of the year, where do you go, and what are your favorite? What are some recommendations? This could be paintings, music, movies. Let's try to, there's so many that I'm just trying to limit mine to, you know, five or six, but Sim, where would you go?
Oh man, there's so much. I mean, obviously the Christmas carols, especially the Disney one and the Muppet one, I mean, are just, I mean, they almost go without saying. They never get old to me. I watch them every year, with my kids. I think I've spent a lot of time just with Christmas carols that I've been really interested. I mean, so, and it's funny, like, but it's hard to find good versions, you know. So the King's College Choir, our local beautiful choir, you can't understand a word there. It's the most beautiful, it's angels singing, but you can't actually hear the words a lot of the time. So that doesn't always actually do it for me. So I find I listen to, you know what I actually listen to when I most want to get into a Christmas mood? Is I listen to Carrie Underwood's version of What Child Is This?
What child is this who lay to rest on Mary's lap is sleeping.
I don't know if it's a particularly good one. It's the one I found one year when I was just looking for one that captured something of the vibe. I was probably really trying to recreate that experience at the Advent in Birmingham all those years ago. Huh. I've been on a huge T.S. Eliot kick in the last year, and he has an extraordinary, intense poem called The Journey of the Magi. It's sort of written from the perspective of the three wise men, and it's really about a world in which Christmas has happened is a world in which you can no longer be at ease with the way things were, or with the normal things about life. Suddenly everything's changed, and it captures that in this no longer at ease in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods. It's an extraordinary poem. Gosh, what else? I'm sure I'm going to think of others, but one that I got, it was, I don't know if it was Dad or John who was the originator here, but The Holly and the Ivy, the old movie about a family in England in a snowstorm getting together, and especially about the, it's about a vicar, a rector of a church who's this very faithful guy, but hasn't succeeded in some ways with his kids in conveying his faith and what's really going on with them, and how it all emerges is absolutely as powerful as any new Christmas material to me in the last few years.
John, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. The movie I love to watch every year at Christmas is Children of Men, has that incredible scene where basically it's the story of a world in which no child has been born in 20 years. And then it's discovered that there is a woman who's pregnant, and she is trying to be sort of ferried away to a safe place where she can give birth to the first child who will have been born in a kind of dystopian, semi-post-apocalyptic world that has lost the hope of a future. And when this child is born, all of the military who are in the middle of fighting all around this child, the moment they hear a child's cry, they put down their weapons and they bask in awe. And it is such a powerful image to me of the strength of love over and against power, and how the imagery of Christmas is juxtaposed with the imagery of sort of military might in that movie. And just the power, when you watch it and you see the reaction of the soldiers when they encounter the baby for the first time, it speaks. So that one I just love, and it's not technically a Christmas movie, but it brings to life the profundity of these themes in a way that really has traction. Another one that I just can't get over is the Christmas special from the show Call the Midwife, about a teenage girl who has gotten pregnant and is trying to hide the fact from her parents and all that she goes through. It was maybe made after the first or second season. And I think about it every year, and I watch it every year, the Call the Midwife Christmas special. Mm. It is unbelievable. And it captures everything about Christmas that I just love. And it talks about every year we annually hold our lives up against the backdrop of this ancient narrative, and how it surfaces all the things that are matter and all the things that are important. So I just love that. My favorite painting probably of all is Caspar David Friedrich's Winter Landscape, that shows the guy who's sort of come to the end of his tough journey in the snow on crutches. And he's sitting in front of a pine thicket against a boulder that he's collapsed on. And he's looking up into the Christmas fir, you know, pine trees, and he's praying. And there he sees Jesus on the cross in the middle of the Christmas trees. And off in the horizon, what he can't see is the cathedral, the sort of hope of heaven and a new day. And that painting for me is both pure Christmas and pure faith. And I just meditate on it all the time. And I love it as a portrait of the Christian faith. And it's very much tied to these Christmas setting, snow and pine trees. And so that one, Winter Landscape by Caspar David Friedrich, I put that on the cover of many Christmas Eve bulletins. Mm. And then what else? There's a TED Talk that came out a few years ago by a guy named Jose Miguel Sokoloff that tells the story of a kind of humanitarian effort to reconnect with young men who had been incorporated into guerrilla movements of militaristic fighting in the jungles of Colombia, South America.
There's a Mockingbird post
and
about
how
this that Brian
in did. Order to kind of get these guys to come home, they would put Christmas lights all over trees in the middle of the jungle, and they would say, "Come home for Christmas," to these young soldiers who had sort of, you know, kind of gone astray, and how there were these powerful messages of this image of Christmas trees in the jungle being this kind of beacon, drawing men and back to themselves and to their families. And it's a TED Talk by Jose Miguel Sokoloff. I think it's called Christmas in the Jungle. And that talk is another sort of poetic image that I just love. And then we haven't mentioned It's a Wonderful Life and The Bishop's Wife, but those are the obvious classic big two. But there's also, lastly, I'll just mention a movie called A Midnight Clear that tells the story of World War II in France, when the German and the American soldiers came together on Christmas Eve in a little truce where they decorated a Christmas tree and sang Christmas hymns together, even though they were on opposite sides of the war. For a night, they were brought together and they hung this Christmas tree with their grenades and their Lugers. Mm-hmm. And they sang Christmas carols together before then having to go back to their respective sides in the war. I think it's called A Midnight Clear is the name of the movie. It has a young Ethan Hawke. And that's a really lovely kind of Christmas movie that's just sort of based on a true story. Remarkable of how Christmas kind of brings a peace. I think that's another theme that we haven't talked about, a sort of peace in the middle of a warring world and a weary world. That we're all kind of craving a peace that is offered in the midst of this blessed night.
Again, we could keep going on for ages. I would have to add W.H. Auden's For the Time Being Christmas Oratorio. I especially like the Advent sections, but then I also like the sort of the day after Christmas stuff that he writes in there. It's just fabulous. I don't think it's ever been bettered, and it's a little easier to understand, I think, than the Journey of the Magi. Just throw that out there. There's an episode of Andy Griffith, the Andy Griffith Show, where they all decide to spend Christmas in the jail with this one guy. It's kind of a Grinchy story that has total grace in it and kind of a descending aspect that I think is it stands the test of time. Dickens story, novella, The Haunted Man. People read The Christmas Carol for good reason. And I just triple down on especially the Muppet Christmas Carol, because I love Paul Williams' songs. And I always think it's funny how Michael Caine, how seriously he took that role. He really brought it, you know. He didn't have to go so hard in The Muppet Christmas Carol, as they say today. But Dickens' story, The Haunted Man, which is it's a ghost story, and it's fabulous. For me, music-wise, the big discovery for me the last few years was Jimmy Webb, the great composer or the songwriter who did, you know, Galveston and Wichita Lineman and countless other songs. He, in 1986, he made an album called The Animals' Christmas, and it was Art Garfunkel and Amy Grant sing on it. And it's an oratorio. It's like half classical, half sort of pop idiom, but it's sacred and beautiful. And I await the day in which it's reissued with bonus material, because it's that good and that unknown.
Then Gabriel came and said to Joseph alone, "Do not be afraid to make Mary your own, but come to your betrothed and then be child is heaven sent." And it came to pass that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world would be taxed, and each went to taxed to his own city. So Joseph also went with his lady innocent.
I really loved The Holdovers this past year that came out as sort of a new modern Christmas movie that I think will return to. I felt that way about 12-Bit Christmas last year. Love that one. I mentioned earlier Calvin and Hobbes, Mary Carr's Descending Theology. Anything Phil Spector related is a big deal in my book. And so I love the fact that he kind of he's obviously this criminal and not a great guy, but he did invent a sound for Christmas music that I happen to love. So anytime someone tries to make a Christmas song like Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, she's aping Phil Spector. And it's just a sound that I like, so that my likelihood of loving these Christmas songs, sacred and secular, is very, very high. So Mockingbird has a bunch of playlists about that. And all of this will be in the show notes as always. But I just want to close with this sort of little fable that I came across from a Catholic writer, a delightful Christmas legend that narrates that among the shepherds that ran on Christmas night to adore the child, there was one who was so poor that he had nothing to offer and was very ashamed. Reaching the grotto, all competed to offer their gifts. Mary did not know what to do to receive them all, having to hold the child in her arms. Then, seeing the shepherd with his hands free, she entrusted Jesus to him. So to have empty hands was his fortune, and on another plane will be also our fortune as well. Apocryphal, but just a beautiful instance of what it means to come empty-handed to the stable full of shipwrecked people.
What's the closing line of A Little Town of Bethlehem? "Where meek hearts will receive him still, the dear Christ enters in." Oh.
Beautiful.
Can't beat it.
Well, Merry Christmas, you guys.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above that deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark streets shine in everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Silently, how silently the wondrous gift is given. So God imparts to human hearts the blessings of all his heaven.
Thanks so much for listening to us do our thing. We hope you've enjoyed it. We do invite you to leave a rating or a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts if you've enjoyed this. And please tell your friends about it. Audio production was provided by TJ Hester. And you can find Mockingbird on the web at www.mbird.com. See you next time.